friends. Welcome to Artistry with Heart, conversations for the musician's soul. I'm Stephanie Lynn Bernards, and today we are having a conversation with Jack Budicky, a pianist, guitarist, educator, and composer whose improvisations and compositions come straight from the soul. He holds several music degrees with an emphasis on jazz and has a wealth of wisdom and grit that make everything he does as a musician incredibly inspiring. The piece you are about to hear is an original composition titled Su Hermano Siempre, which he will tell you all about later on in this episode. What you are about to hear will undoubtedly leave you inspired and empowered to stick with your dreams and trust your path. Let's jump in.
Just do the beat.
Yep, just there. Start
and
there.
I think they think it is. They're looking for this magical thing, and it isn't that.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's just vocabulary.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when you get it, you know, get it ingrained and you can do it with passion and heart, then it becomes magic.
Jack, I'm so honored to have you with me today.
Well,
welcome.
I appreciate that, and I'm so happy to be here and feel so lucky and blessed to have worked with you. And I started off working with Lisa Marsh, who I know is very important to you, and she steered me towards you, and I'm so thankful for that. And the holistic approach you use of really working on postural and also working on mental health aspects of playing has been so valuable for me, and it's really, even at the age of 70, I feel like I'm still growing and still learning, and that's really, really comforting to me.
Well, you know, you hold a wealth of wisdom and grit that makes everything you do as a musician incredibly inspiring. So I love being around you because you inspire me to keep doing the heavy lifting, which maybe we can get into a little more later on in this episode. But I'm so excited to have everyone hear from you today. And thanks for all of your kind words. It's
right back at you.
Yeah, this whole thing is super mutual.
Yes, indeed.
So, Jack, when I was studying up on you, I learned that you began playing piano when you were in college at the University of Oregon.
Correct.
You received a golf scholarship there.
Yes.
So did you have any exposure to music prior to college?
Not really. The house I grew up in was not musical at all. There was rarely music playing, so I really wasn't exposed to any music. And I kind of discovered that practicing anything was really a comfort to me. So I, you know, at 12 or 13, I started playing golf. It was, you know, super affordable. I came from, you know, a middle-class family, both parents, civil service workers. And I literally would, you know, go to the golf course every day and and just kind of wild away there. And in retrospect, having a panic disorder and anxiety disorder, I realized that that was a really soothing thing for me to do. It really didn't matter what I was practicing, but it was a comforting thing to do. So that was something I did literally every day for, you know, till I was 17 or 18 on there. And then when I got to University of Oregon, and that would have been 1971, and the music world was just exploding at that point with so many different things. And I started to get exposed to that, that in concert with starting to really, really struggle competitively with anxiety. There's a condition called the yips, that where you have such a, you know, panicked, anxious response to any kind of pressure that you become unable to function. And I got to that point where it was really very, very difficult and very troubling to do that. And I channel all of that practice energy into music. And, you know, I was around a lot of musicians there. Eugene was a really, really exciting place at that point. There were so many people living there, you know, Nancy King and Sonny King and the Nighthawks, which was Robert Cray and Curtis Salgado's band, and it was just everywhere there, and it was so fun to be around that. So lucky for me to be around that.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. So what would you say, like, helped you through that first onset, I guess, of performance anxiety? Is that sort of the first time it ever surfaced with you?
I think it had been there all my life, but that was the first manifestation of it that I was really aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've always been that way. And in my studies, being an adopted kid, there's all sorts of work and data about, you know, that abandonment is very real.
Yeah.
From a very, very young age. And I was always had, you know, an insecurity and difficulty with, you know, anything that involved pressure on there. And household was pretty challenging. I had a brother that was struggled with addiction. And I was kind of as I got older, I was the main kind of caretaker for him. And so I was, you know, lots of times coming back down from Eugene to get him into a rehab and to try and facilitate, you know, some improvement, which really never happened. And that was a time where there was so few resources and so much less information. So it was a tricky and challenging time.
Yeah, I mean, what a setup, right? I mean, geez, yeah. Louise. And I think that, you know, we're going to dig into this more in a little bit, but I think that performance anxiety is often rooted in these stories, right?
Yes.
Like, it's not just,
absolutely,
like, I have a little stage fright. It's, like, so much
yes.
deeper than that, right?
I know that you know this.
Yeah, I mean, I know my own version of it.
Yes.
But I think that when you can kind of identify where it's coming from, at least you have something to work with rather than just
yes.
this, like, debilitating fear that this
absolutely.
Is just the way it's meant to be, or that you're just born this way, or
yep.
you just came out that way. And, you know, we're a product of what's been done to us a lot of the time.
Absolutely. I think it is all very trauma-based, and it was quite a relief to me to actually have some explanation of it.
Yeah.
Because I lived, you know, I was, I think, 29 when I first, you know, heard someone say, oh, those are panic attacks.
Oh, yeah.
And we were living in Nevada at that point, and I was, my brother had passed away about 3 months earlier, and all of a sudden, I was driving home from a gig about 3 a.m. around the rim of Lake Tahoe. You know, beautiful snowstorm with one of my best friends, and we were having our usual existential conversation, and it was lovely. And all of a sudden I was hyperventilating and had no idea what was going on. And I think I had 7 emergency room trips in about 8 months until I finally found someone that was a mental health professional that explained what it was. And again, that was a huge relief.
Wow.
And once I understood what it was, then, it was much easier to deal with, because before I understood that, it was like, oh God, I'm having a heart attack. I'm completely falling apart. And then I knew, and then I started to get resources to help with it. This was before there was any medicines, and the SSRIs did not really exist at that point. But again, just having that, I really, my main approach was exercise. So I think from that, you know, from 20s on, I probably played, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, 2 hours a day of hard basketball.
Wow.
And I did that into my, you know, early 60s. And that was that, I just wore myself out, and it really, really made a giant difference. And obviously that became impractical at some point to keep doing on there. But that's how I managed it.
I'm very familiar with that. I love to take out I've loved to take out all the hard stuff on exercise myself. It works, but then it stops working as soon as you become injured, or
you can't do all
the things you
want
to do.
That's true.
Then you're just with yourself, and
yes.
you're like, God.
And I realize now when I would get injured that it was such a panic-inducing thing.
Yeah.
Because I lost access to my main resource on there, and, you know, whereas other people were going, okay, in a couple weeks I'll do something else.
Yeah.
Not so much for me.
Yeah. I totally understand. Yeah. My now husband was like laughing at me because, you know, when we first started dating, I would use running as my tool to escape from any kind of anxiety. And I had acquired this really terrible injury where I was not able to run and I was able to bike. So we were in the middle of a conversation and all of a sudden I have this spike of anxiety and I'm like, I have to ride my bike right now. So I run to the closet, grab my bike, run out the door. He's like, it looked like you were going to go like save somebody from a severe emergency. I mean, it was just amazing how I would like need to turn to something to take out that energy. And you see that kind of cropping up in all these ways. I found that being injured actually is helpful because then at the end of the day, you do have to figure out how to deal with whatever is causing that anxiety in the first place.
And well said.
So I'm grateful for injuries in this backwards kind of way because like performance anxiety, it's like you can't just keep blacking out when you perform. You have to eventually ask yourself why.
And
then you kind of come to this place of understanding that everything has a root cause and it's not just like you're doomed. It's like information is power and that's how we move through these things, you know.
Do I understand that?
So I love that you were so willing to share that with us. And I feel like that kind of sets the stage for my questions about music. And tell us a little bit about you had a little bit of a late starting music in college, seriously. So tell me about, again, like, how exactly did you and music meet? Like, what was that first moment where you're like, I want to do this? And then, you know, how has it evolved over the years? How has your musical journey evolved over the years, especially with this whole other component of,
right,
of having an anxiety disorder and all these other components, right?
Yep, absolutely. Well, I think, again, it was just being exposed to music, and Eugene was so electric with exposure, and you know, I had literally not listened to music at all, and I would walk into a record shop and they were, you know, playing Kind of Blue, or they were playing, you know, an Allman Brothers record, or the first two Cat Stevens or Elton John, all of those, and Moondance, all of those were coming out at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was just, boy, it was just amazing to me to listen to that, and I became pretty obsessed with listening. And then I started to be around some people that were playing, and I said, well, this could, you know, be my practice,
yeah.
My practice thing. And back then, you know, the U of O Music School was, you know, was wide open, so you could just go sit in a practice room. You didn't need to be a music major. And myself and actually one of my oldest friends I still play with, Jeff Homan, we would just be in those music rooms for 5 or 6 hours. I'd start there at, you know, at 9 in the morning. I'd play till noon. Then I'd run over to Mac Court and play basketball for 2 hours, and I'd go back to the practice rooms and repeat.
Yeah.
And rinse. So I started to, you know, I started to play well enough where I got to start playing with other people. And I ended up, you know, getting in a couple groups. They were all groups doing original music. You know, I bought my first Fender Rhodes right around then, which would have been 1972. Still have that,
yeah,
instrument.
That.
And, you know, started to experience the joy of playing with people, the social part of music, which was really family, especially when it was working. And that really sold me on it. And the collaborative aspect of it, the group that I had the most success with, which was called the Lon Gitarski Group, we were working, you know, over 20 times a month. And we would practice 5 days a week for 4 hours.
Wow.
And everybody was just so into it. And, you know, back then, everyone was making $100 a gig. And my rent was $50. And it was just, you know, a beautiful bohemian environment where you could do that. And for some reason, all four of us realized that. And we took it seriously like a job. And we were playing all instrumental music, all original music, working really hard. So I got the taste of collaborating, which is my favorite thing to this day. I love working with people where everyone's contributing, that synergistic effect.
Yeah.
And we were very successful, got a record contract. And
wow.
Once we got the record contract, then we started to have trouble interpersonally.
Yeah.
Won't go into that too much, but and that really kind of sabotaged that experience through there. But that was my good fortune that really, you know, got me. I really wanted, boy, I would love to be able to do this and make a living doing it.
Yeah, and were you primarily a pianist at that point, or were you guitarist?
I did a little
both?
Bit of guitar. Maybe two or three songs on guitar, but mostly keyboard.
Okay. Okay.
And that was most of the practice I was doing. And when I started, I was writing a bunch there, which was another wonderful piece of luck there. It was an environment where I could write, and I could bring in these sketches. And it was a quartet at that point. All four of us would collaborate to work out our parts. And really came up, and the piece that we'll listen to later is an example of that, of that collaborative process. And it was just such a just really wonderful experience to be able to do that. And and lifelong friends,
right.
On there. It really was a family, which I didn't realize at that point, but it was a family connection that I had not had prior.
Wow. Music has that way of connecting us all in that really special way, especially when you are lucky enough to find people musically who align with your values and your visions. It's like one of the best gifts.
Yes, it is. It is awesome.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah. So fast forward, you're 70, which I never would have known, by the way. And you have a very youthful energy about you. And you're doing all the things you love still. And that's just really important to remember that you can do these things at any age.
Absolutely.
And but needless to say, so you're here now. What does your musical life look like now? I know that you double majored in piano and guitar with an emphasis in jazz. And can you just tell us a little bit about what you're doing now? I know you teach and you perform, and what does that look like? And kind of what is your underlying motivator with all of these things that you do musically?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I'm the thing I've been doing the most lately is I got involved with the Portland Youth Jazz Orchestra.
Nice.
And they have a professional level big band, and I've been playing in that for a couple years, which has just been a blast. Some of my old friends from back in the Eugene days that I've known for 50 years are playing in that band, so it's really socially a wonderful thing on top of very, very challenging for me musically. So I'm doing that, and then I'm also playing in a smaller combo with that group where I play guitar and I play piano in the big band in there. So that's been my main musical focus.
Nice.
We have a group right now. We're playing with my two daughters and three of their friends, and that's been really, really, really fun too. Where I'm just kind of my wife plays bass, and we're both kind of flies on the wall, and they pick all the music and they run the rehearsals, and we get to we do some gigs occasionally with that. But that's really fun. It's just to make music with your family is the best.
Yeah, no kidding.
Rather than having to make new family with your plate, you actually can use your family to play on there. So that's been wonderful. And, I've been lucky enough to do lots of gigs with, my wife and my kids.
Wow.
And they still love doing it. And so that's where I'm at. I get projects, a couple of friends who are directors. And so I'm most recently did a, wrote the music for a musical version of King Lear, and I get projects like that, which I love. I love people coming in and saying, this is the narrative, and this is the mood and the vibe of this piece. I love that kind of challenge of trying to find that musically. I really love, I love composing. I love soundtracking, and I think I started playing guitar more and more because it allowed me a different voice for writing. It was sometimes I would get stuck on the keyboard and I could pick up a guitar and sometimes find the direction that I wanted to go on that. And I never really planned on pursuing it that much, but I love being at PSU. Studying with Randy Porter for 4 years was just wonderful. Randy and yourself and Lisa were really the influences and all that, and I took away from all of those and meant that, God, maybe I can do this at that level. Mm-hmm. I kind of saw myself as more an imposter before that, and I learned on my own, and if I had enough time, I could learn the stuff. But I started to, through yourself and Lisa and Randy, to think, okay, maybe I can do this, and boy, what a gift that was.
Imposter syndrome is such a thing, right?
I'm there, baby.
And it doesn't seem to, it doesn't matter who it is, too. No. It's like, it doesn't matter what level yep. or anything. It's just yep. there's this idea that we're faking it or something, yep. or somebody's going to find us out. And yep. it's just like, it's kind of ridiculous. But it at the is. Same time, it's completely relatable and understandable. And I struggle with it myself. I haven't actually talked to a person who hasn't at least struggled with it at some point yeah. in their career. And yeah. I think, what do you think the root of that is?
Like, well, I think it's baked in for me, that insecurity pretty early on, and maybe it's even yeah. back to,
yeah.
you know, adoption and being, you know, in a family that I was definitely taken care of and I was loved, but, you know, I always felt like I was a little far from the tree.
Yeah.
To use the title of that book.
What's the book?
It's called, Away, Far From the Tree, I believe. Okay. And it talks about being a child in a household where you're not really connected. I was, you know, I was very sensitive. You know, I was the kid in Little League that was, you know, sitting on the bench crying and the coach yelling, quit being so sensitive. And they would keep playing because I was the best player on the team, so they keep tolerating it. But I was always, you know, and as a boy, that's a big thing. You know, what? Quit thinking about that. Quit being so sad. And I, you know, got that from my parents, all of that stuff. And I didn't know how to do that. it's a, you know, that was my wiring. And I think that and, you know, that insecurity and maybe even the abandonment of adoption, all of that stuff. Intellectually, I understand. I have a pretty good, I think, view of what my abilities are. But when I get in certain environments, I still, you know, in the big band, they'll, when we're reading new music and they throw something on there that's, you know, it says it's a 220 and it's like,
yeah.
I kind of relate to it like, you know, because I didn't really learn to read till I was in my 40s. And I kind of look at it like I was in my 20s going, oh God, can we do it at 100? So yeah, it's a great question.
Do you think a lot of it kind of might be stemmed from being adopted, or is that?
There is a lot
what
of
is your theory?
There's a lot of data on that says, you know, that there is the infant will definitely feel that abandonment,
right,
you know, right off the bat, and that yeah. you're always trying to. They say that adopted kids they always feel like they have to do twice as much to really to fit in and to stay yeah. connected to the family. And one of the fun things in this big band is I've got, you know, two or three people there who have gone through the same thing and, you know, have done birth family searches and all that stuff. And we all have frighteningly similar experiences.
Yeah.
And we can compare, you know, who has the worst imposter syndrome. And I do.
Yeah.
On that stuff. But I think it's a big part of it. And I think the sensitivity is a lot of it, though. The highly sensitive person, it's a little trickier to
yeah.
navigate. And I think almost all of us who choose this kind of approach are that way.
Yeah.
The world is not easy right now for
highly sensitive
HSPs.
Yeah, no, I think that's so helpful for people to hear, because I think a lot of the time we just, again, assume that we're just this way because. And I think the more we do the digging around the why, the more we can actually start healing, don't you?
Absolutely.
Is that true of your experience?
It is, and it was certainly a revelation to me to be able to have access to counseling and start to understand all of these things.
Yeah.
And understand that it's not a fixable thing, but there's so many resources and there's a lot of peace and comfort in knowing, okay, this is what this is.
Yeah.
And when it starts to happen, okay, damn it, there it comes again. But you know what it is. Whereas before it was like, I'm having a heart attack, they dropped me off at the asylum, this is not good.
Yeah.
I did, when we lived in Nevada, I was literally doing gigs with a paper bag on my roads for when I hyperventilated.
Really?
Yes. I'd sit up right next to a curtain and then I'd duck behind the curtain and go,
oh, wow.
And again, I had no idea what was going on. You know, I know I wanted to do those gigs. I wanted to keep playing. But yeah, it was, and it just, panic disorder is something where you go to fight or flight for no reason.
Yeah.
So you can't, there's no trigger, there's no reason it's happening. And for me, it almost always happens in the most peaceful situations.
Isn't that wild?
I think it's because I think I just let down, and you know, all of the guards that are up all the time, you know, and like especially in nature, and some of those, you know, where we'd be playing Sunday morning, you know, on a veranda overlooking Lake Tahoe, and all of a sudden I'm hyperventilating. What? This makes no sense, but it does make sense.
Yeah.
I think there's a, you get comfortable and your body, the defenses stop.
Yeah.
Through there.
Yeah. Well, isn't that interesting, though, that you can finally be at peace? You're like, oh, I'm safe. Things are safe.
Yes.
And all of a sudden,
yes.
All mayhem just is completely released.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. But it's a gift because then you can actually start processing all of the things that are holding you back. And
there are a lot of, so many resources now. And
yeah.
I do like a tapping routine that I can pretty much stop it, you know, when I feel it coming.
Yeah.
And it still does. It still happens. And, you know, I have episodic medicine I can use, and I, you know, take the daily SSRI, all of those things mute it, but it's still there. That
yeah.
wiring is, you know, deep.
Yeah.
Deep in there.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of just segued into where I wanted to go, which is how do you cope with your own performance anxiety, and like kind of what are some ways you strategize around it? I don't believe it's necessarily something you can overcome. I mean, maybe
right.
for some people it is. It's something I'm kind of realizing is a byproduct of past experiences.
Yes.
Right. And I have my own strategies, but I'm curious what yours are, and also what your underlying why is that like keeps bringing you back. Right. I mean, some people are like, this is so debilitating, this fear. This fear of imperfection, this fear of being an imposter, this fear of not being enough. It's so paralyzing, and we all know that.
Yep.
But there's something that keeps us coming back to work through it. And I'm curious, you know, for listeners out there that maybe would love to hear what motivates you to keep working through this stuff.
That's a wonderful question, and it's definitely the $64,000 question. I think I've been very lucky. I have, you know, a partner who we're coming up on 40 years of marriage, and who has always been totally supportive of that. And
yeah.
when that was first happening, and we lived in Nevada, and we lived really out in the middle of nowhere, and I would wake up in bed hyperventilating, I would run out into the desert and to the top of the hill, I cry for a half hour, then I feel fine, I go back, and that was happening time after time. And, you know, she's always stuck with me on that, and still is sticking with me, because it still goes on. I think that's been so, so helpful.
Yeah.
I think coming from a family of addiction, I really reacted to, I'm not going to do that, because it would have been very easy to do that, to self-medicate.
Mm-hmm.
To help that, which, you know, so many people do. And now I have children that are a child that struggles with that, so I'm I'm really just dedicated to getting as much information, and here's a new thing that I can share with her, and so that we can, you know, talk about that, and hopefully that stuff gets better for the next generation, you know, that hopefully we're parenting better to where there isn't going to be that trauma. That, you know, our goal really was breaking cycles in our family.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of it. But music is reflexive. I couldn't stop doing it.
Exactly, right.
If I wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think music really can heal so much, and it can help us work through so many traumas. And I always joke about it, but like, I mean, the reason why I do these interviews, I want to do them at the piano now, is because people just tell their stories.
Yes.
When they start playing music, or they start learning music, or they come back to music, or they're trying to like record something, or they're about to perform. It's like you see inside of this other part of a person that you don't normally get to see.
Yep.
It's like this interesting mirror. And so I just think, you know, music is so healing, and yet it can also have this other side to it of just so much fear and judgment. And I think that the way that you've handled it and used it to, you know, heal yourself, heal your generational trauma, like work through these cycles so that they aren't continued, is obviously reflected in the music that you play and improvise and create. So hats off to you, Jack, because that is hard work.
I appreciate it.
It's really hard work.
That's the easy, you know, I think I have anxiety all the time, so it's not like oh God, I've got to play music. I'm going to be more.
Right. It's going to be here. I may as well do what I love.
It's constant. And the environment, and you've witnessed this because you see me play, you know, classical music at a recital, which is terrifying to me. Yeah. Playing by myself and playing, you know, really from a script, as opposed to, oh, I'm here with my mates and my good buddies and, you know, we've rehearsed this and I don't have to play exactly the same thing every time. That actually can be comforting and healing. And I think I there's part of me that's just drawn to wanting to get better at doing that, as you've witnessed. Yeah. And it's terrifying. And yeah. I don't know how people do it. Yeah. I watch a you know, a concert pianist do that stuff and I go, God, how do you do that? I mean, do you know who Victor Borge is?
Yeah,
so I can just think of, you know, making a comedy routine now, but almost I'm really struggling and grabbing a paper bag and then, you know, going off on a tangent. But yeah, it's such an impressive thing to watch people to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I'm in awe of that.
Yeah.
It's such an impressive skill.
Yeah.
And I think mentally it's so amazing because, you know, as you know, you have to be able to play with an absence of tension, especially with the, you know, the virtuosic music that's being played, and boy, that's hard.
Yes, it is. But you've come so far with the classical component.
I appreciate that, and I really love doing it, and I do it every day. That's the only thing I practice is I go through my, you know, classical routine every day on there, and it is noticeably improved, and it's helped everything else I do.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what pieces are you currently working on?
So I think my rotation is I've got two Rachmaninoffs, the E minor, I think it's an E minor Presto, and then the G minor Prelude.
Mm-hmm. Love
and
it.
And then the Pathétique, Beethoven, first movement. And I play a couple of Chopin pieces. I play the Revolutionary Etude and one of the very first etude, which is the Liszt arpeggiated one, I don't know what that's called, and, you know, some Bach stuff every day, but it's all stuff that pushes me technically, and I think some of those pieces I've been playing for 7 or 8 years now, and I'm finally getting to where, you know, I have it where it's muscle memory on there, and it just, again, makes me so impressed with people that can do that, because I know that work and time that has to go into that. And the counterintuitiveness of being able to relax while you're doing this thing that is so damn hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was curious because, you know, when I watch you play these pieces, you have come so far in such a short amount of time, but when I see you improvise, it's like you were born to do it. And I'm curious because a lot of people are like really freaked out about improvising. And I've heard some people say, in fact, that they just can't. Do you think that some people can and others just...
No, I think it's a learnable thing. And I have a one of my colleagues that we teach a class. She's a tap dancer.
Oh, cool.
And we teach a tap dance class in improvisation. And it's, I think, the majority of people come in there, and once you say that word, you can just see their shoulders go up, and they go, oh, God, I can't do that. And I just think there's a mythology, you know, very similar to what you did with your master classes, that people think it's a gift, and that people can do it and people can't do it. And no, I don't believe that. I think it's a learnable thing. I think speaking is improvising.
Exactly.
You develop vocabulary, and that vocabulary really gets ingrained, and then you're able to express yourself spontaneously doing that. I don't think it's any different than that, but I think it's just people have been conditioned to think it's this magical thing, and it's just vocabulary, and then I'm being also in a comfortable environment where you can experiment with it.
Yeah.
On there, but no, I totally think it's learned. What? How about you?
Oh, of course, I'm right there with you.
Good.
I know. I always laugh when people just say like, "Oh, you're just so talented." I'm like, no. I just don't give up.
Yes. Yeah. I totally agree.
You know, people only want to see the final product, and when they actually see the, you know, the process and how messy and embarrassing and all these things, people are like, "Oh, well, maybe you're not as talented as I thought you were." And it's just ridiculous. I think I do understand. It's always, you know, meant as a compliment, but it's just, not true. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to work for everything. And I think it's just like learning how to speak. How are you going to speak? You know, you're going to speak differently than somebody else. And maybe you will in absolutely sound different than someone else. And that's the point. So I just wanted to throw that in. That was kind of an aside. But
no, absolutely. And I think that's such an important thing. And I hate the word talent to be in with. I just think it implies that you've been touched by something with a gift, and and I just think it's work and passion.
Yeah,
you know, when you're ignited on something and you love it, you can keep doing it, and then you get some, you know, you get some crumbs. Well, God, I'm getting better at this, and you get motivated. Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thanks for affirming that.
I'm
always trying to convince people that it's just hard work times like duration of time.
That's a hard one. And some
being surrounded by the right people.
Yeah, and people are, you know, and that tap dance class, we would say, okay, everybody improvise, and they, I can't.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. Well, just do the beat.
Yep, just there. Start
and
there.
I think they think it is. They're looking for this magical thing, and it isn't that.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's just vocabulary.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when you get it, you know, get it ingrained and you can do it with passion and heart, then it becomes magic.
Yeah, amen. Put that on my wall. So I have a couple more questions for you before we wrap it up. When I was reading about you, Jack, you said something that really inspired me. You said that you look at music as service. And trying to make an impact on a student or audience member is what you aspire to. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always felt like that. I get really rejuvenated from doing stuff where, and you know, especially these days, and we play a lot at the, we used to play a lot at the beach in Manzanita, at this hot dog stand out there. And just, it's all families, and it's just, you know, just seeing people having a good time with their family is wonderful. That's the payment that I look for in all that stuff, is it's something I've always been pretty obsessed with contributing and wanting to do something, you know, of service. And to me, that's what music is, you know, inspiring people, like we were just talking about. They know you can do this. This is not magic. It just, if you're passionate about it, you put the work into it, you can do it. And I really don't like the culture that's kind of around music right now, because we really do we're so starstruck about things. And I think I love that class so much that you did, where, you know, people, where you go up there and talk, this piece I've been working on for 20 years and I finally got this part now on there, and it's so valuable to hear people talk like that on there, rather than they did learn that in a week, and there they go.
Yeah.
Yes, that's so important to hear, but there's so many misconceptions on that and misinformation that it is this magical thing. You know, certainly in athletics, it's the same way. You see incredible, you know, like especially things like ice skating and that kind of thing, where they're practicing 10 hours a day and they're black and blue all the time, and then we only see the performance. And wow, on there, it's just, it's a real testament to persistence of whoever's doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And more. Love it. Okay, so at the beginning of the episode, I featured your beautiful original, Su Hermano Siempre, and we'll listen to the rest after this podcast. I'm just curious if you could tell us about the inspiration behind this piece, what it means. My Spanish is lacking. I think it means my brother forever.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Your brother always.
Okay.
And this was a trip. I was up at the University of Oregon, and my brother was having trouble, and we had a close family friend who found a rehab in Monterey. And so I drove down from Eugene and picked him up in Palo Alto. And we drove down to the halfway house, and we went in there, and they said, well, he can't come in until you can certify he's been clean for 24 hours. And he said, you go over to this motel here that's right by the emergency room and sit with him for 24 hours, and then we can take him. So we went and got this motel room, and, you know, he got very sick, which is what happens in that situation.
Yeah.
But I just started, you know, I had a guitar with me, and I started to, you know, find the themes of this song as I was just trying to distract myself. And, you know, it's just so heartbreaking and awful to watch that stuff. And I found out a lot later that he was a fetal alcohol kid, also adopted, which we didn't know. So he had a really hard he had a hard road. Yeah. But anyway, so that was, me just trying to stay awake and and do whatever I could to comfort him, to get him through that period, to where I could get him, get him admitted to this rehab, which only lasted a week, which was pretty typical back then. They were very military or boot camp like back then, and he was a sensitive kid, and that just didn't. He needed a different approach on that stuff. But that's where that song came from. So that song always had tremendous meaning for me because of the environment and because of, he's someone I miss daily. He died at 27, so it's been, well over 40 years on there. And I go out of my way to, to stay connected to that as much as I can.
Yeah.
Because there's a silver lining in that stuff.
Yeah. Wow, that is a powerful and heart-wrenching story. I love that people will get to hear this piece, and I know that they'll hear it with a fresh set of ears now that they have had a chance to hear the story.
Yeah, and I loved, the way everybody, all of my mates played on it too, was they knew what would, what the root of that was, and they played their hearts out on it and developed parts on it, and so it's really a collaborative piece in terms of, there's a lot of things that sound composed. And those things are actually parts that the bass player developed and the drummer developed, all of those things. So I love that everybody contributed to it, and I think it's always greater than the sum of its parts when that happens.
Amen to that. Yeah. Wow, that's beautiful. Oh wow. Well, I could talk to you all day. I guess I want to just wrap up with a question I like to finish off with. With everyone, which is, since music is the expression of ideas and emotions, how do you actively honor your mind, body, spirit as a musician? You can take that in any direction, but how do you honor yourself?
Well, I look at music as we talked about earlier, service, and the other thing I look at is storytelling. Mm. So I think that's why I like projects where someone says this is the narrative and this is what's going on, or if it's a film, this is what's going on in the scene. Mm. I love being a part of that storytelling. I've always loved doing theater for that regard, and just being being collaborative and contributing to something that again may brighten people's day and may inspire them. And I think that's what I try and do. It's a way to contribute.
Absolutely.
And I know you probably are the same way, because you're that way with me as a student. I have a lot of students where, that half hour went by and you never played.
Yeah.
we just did a therapy session. I'm not doing therapy, but I'm listening, because that's what needed to happen for there. And that's just not happening enough, especially for kids these days. They're just trying to make their way in a world that is just really hard to understand right now. And it's, the word you just use, it is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And so to be, of some comfort there is that I'm better when I put my head on the pillow at the end of the day when that's happened. And
yeah.
I know you're the same way.
Yeah. Well, I certainly strive to be. And I think, what you said about, looking at music as service, it's so rejuvenating for all parts, mind, body, spirit, just all of the parts of yourself that you want to bring with you everywhere.
Absolutely.
And it's not this isolated thing. It's you bring yourself everywhere, and the more integrated we can be and the more grounded in our why, the better off. And our whys can be different, but I do think that when you have this higher purpose and you don't get swept away by the whole hype of wanting people to be starstruck with you or thinking that that's even the goal or something.
Absolutely.
And that there's such a higher purpose there that we can all strive for in our own unique ways. Like, that's the beauty of everyone just embracing their authentic voice, whatever that sounds like. So I love that you shared that. And
amen on all of that. And I think it's a way to approach life, and I approach everything I do that way, whether it's music or whatever task I'm doing, that's how I approach it. I'm hopefully to make a difference and improve and, make the world better in whatever little way that I can. I it's just, for some reason, the way I've chose to go about living.
I love it. Well, that's why I was so excited to talk with you today. And I am curious how listeners can get in touch with you and learn more about your music. And is your score available for people to find online? Yes,
I have a website, which is called buzzardsovervienna.com.
Okay.
And that's all of my catalog is on there.
Oh, sweet.
And that would be on there also. I am very, I've always been very, very obsessed with melody. And I think the last in classical music, I think Vienna was kind of the height of the composers who really valued melody over everything. So that's was my little play on words, Buzzards Over Vienna, kind
Love
of
it.
The death of melody. And we have a lot less of that going on these days, at least in the mainstream through there. But yes, and there's ways to email from there and all
Great.
That stuff.
Buzzardsovervienna.com.
Correct.
Great. Well, I'm sure people will find you via that way. And I am excited for people to hear the rest of your piece as we wrap it up here. But thank you so much, Jack,
thank you for
coming and having this conversation with me and letting me share it with the world.
I appreciate it. And I'm really so supportive of what you do, because I feel like we have the values of the same way, the way you teach. I aspire to, and I learn from that all the time. And just to make a difference.
Exactly.
Make people better.
That's what we're here for.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's like time we all just kind of get on board with that.
I'm
that's what
I'm
this
there.
Is about.
I'm there and you're there.
Yeah, let's just all be on that page.
Yes, I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
But thank you.
But
I
thank you
really
so much,
appreciate
Jack.
It.
All right. Well, for those of you that want to get in touch with Jack, remember you can find him at buzzardsovervienna.com, and please stay tuned for the rest of this original composition, Su Hermano Siempre. And we hope that you will stay tuned for future episodes like this one. And thank you again so much for joining us, Jack. Until next time, be you and stay inspired. I'm Stephanie Lynn Bernards. Mm-hmm.